Bien, merci de prendre vos places. Je souhaite la bienvenue au professeur Nama Friedman qui vient spécialement de Tel Aviv nous parler de ses travaux. Et je suis extrêmement heureux de l'accueillir à nouveau au Collège de France. I'll switch to English to tell you that Nama, we're extremely happy to have you here in Collège de France again, because this is the second talk you give in the seminar. So for those of you who are interested in developmental deficits, Nama gave a remarkably interesting talk on developmental dyslexias. I use the plural specifically because this is really the key message. There is not one form of dyslexia, but several forms of dyslexia. And in the talk, I think 2 years ago or 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I think, Nama gave us a wonderful explanation of how to diagnose different forms of dyslexia and convincing evidence that these different forms need to be distinguished. So today, she will expand the message in another direction by telling us about specific language impairments, and again, in the plural, the idea that there are many different levels at which deficits can exist. I want to say a few words about Nama. To say she is very special because she has intense contacts with the developmental deficits community, the neuropsychological community. Many of us started in the cognitive science through neuropsychology, the study of patients, either acquired deficits or developmental deficits. And many of us moved then to brain imaging as one way to look inside the brain for which structures are responsible for reading or for language. But Nama kept this remarkable pathway of analysis of the deficits, neuropsychology. And I think she is one of the best representatives in the world now of the power of this neuropsychological approach to understand the organization of the normal system. The deficits shed light on the normal organization. And we will see that we need to make distinctions that are quite subtle inside what superficially looks like, you know, language impairment. So probably we should not be talking about language impairment in the singular, but be very specific about which level the deficit is occurring. So welcome, Nama. It's really great to have you again this time. Speak about evidence for modularity in developmental language impairments.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me well? Okay. I'm very, very happy to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. And what I'm going to do today is, as Professor Doyan told you, talk about plurality again, but this time with respect to developmental language impairments. So in general, I'm going to talk a little bit about what is developmental language impairment, and then talk about specific types of language impairments in children and adolescents and adults with developmental impairments. And I'm going to talk about modularity both within and between. So I'm going to talk about whether language can be impaired without other cognitive impairments, and in what ways language can be selectively impaired. So different language domains can be selectively impaired. I will then talk about some sources for SLIs, specific language impairment, and put a special focus on critical periods. So I'll try to convince you that there is a critical period for language acquisition, and actually that there are different critical periods for different domains of language. And when we talk about language impairments in plural, the reason we talk about language impairments in plural is because there are different language domains. So when someone knows language, to know a language is actually to know several domains of language. One would be syntax, so knowing the set of rules of the structure of sentences and phrases, knowing word orders. The other would be phonology, knowing the sounds of a language and the way they can combine. The other would be pragmatics, knowing the rules of discourse. How do we communicate with each other? How much information do we give? Lexica, the plural of lexicons, knowing the words, their written form, their phonological form, their semantics. And when we talk about semantics, we also talk about meaning. It could be meaning at the level of words, understanding words, but it also could be meaning of sentences. For example, understanding negation, understanding quantifiers like all or some. So in fact, when we talk about language domains, first of all, we talk about several different domains: syntax, phonology, pragmatics. But we also talk within each domain, we talk about different abilities and different functions. So, for example, when we talk about syntax, we talk about syntactic movement, which will be one of the foci of our discussion today. We talk about building a syntactic tree. When we talk about phonology, we can talk about knowledge of the phonemes, of the sounds of the language, but we can also talk about phonological working memory, about the ability to hold these phonemes for a short time. We said lexicon. We have different lexicons, and we talk about semantics, we have lexical and sentence-level semantics. And the idea is that each of these types of language knowledge can be selectively impaired and give rise to developmental language impairments. So we might see individuals with a selective impairment in phonology, for example. In this case, we will see, and I'll show you later, children or adolescents. Instead of saying all the time children or adolescents or adults, I'll try to say individuals, but in general the idea is that developmental language impairments exist from birth and then they stay. It's not something that goes away. So you could see it in children, but you could also see it in adults who have been living with this impairment for all their lives. And I'll show you later evidence showing that these things don't go away without treatment. So we could see individuals with phonological impairments. They might make phonological errors, saying the wrong phoneme or omitting one of the phonemes when you have a cluster of phonemes. So instead of saying cluster, saying custer, for example. You could see people with a problem in pragmatics. So you would ask, do you know what the time is? And they would say, yes. Okay, or give you too much information. How are you today? And then starting to give you how they are today in detail. Not always. We don't always want that, right? So there could be impairments in pragmatics. There could be impairments in the lexicon. And in this case, people will not be able to retrieve the written form of the word or the phonological form of the word or the semantic form of the word. And we could see problems in semantics. People who will not understand sentences like some of the people are gray-haired. Okay. Okay, so when we talk about specific language impairment, the term is usually people say, don't say developmental language impairment, they say specific language impairment, or SLI, specific language impairment. Why do they use the term specific? Because, and this is already from the 19th, actually from the 80s, people say the language is specifically impaired without other reasons for this impairment. So the idea was to say if a child has intellectual disability, or if a child has autism, or if a child has another reason or brain damage, we will not call it specific language impairment or hearing impairment. So in the early term of specific language impairment referred to the fact that it is specific to language and is not part of hearing impairment or autism or intellectual disability. Now in recent years, people think that maybe it's not really fair. Because if a child has an intellectual disability and also has a language impairment, maybe we want to be aware of the language impairment and we want to be able to treat this language impairment. So the specificity stays in the name, but not necessarily in the way we talk about language impairments. But what I would like to suggest is that it's not only specific because it's not part of autism or not part of intellectual disability. I would actually like to add that there are specific language impairments, right? So if we talk about a specific impairment in syntax, it is a syntactic language impairment. So I will try to use the term syntactic SLI or SISLI syntactic SLI or just a syntactic impairment. So I'm going to start by talking about people who have syntactic impairments and ask whether they could have a selective impairment in syntax. So whether it could be that they have a deficit in syntax with good lexicons and good phonology and good pragmatics. And obviously there are people who have more than one deficit, right? So there are people who have a syntactic deficit and a phonological deficit. But the important point that I want to make is an existential claim. I want to say that there exist people who have a problem only in syntax, and other people who have a problem only in phonology, and others who have a problem only in semantics, pragmatics, lexicons. Right? And this is what I will try to call specific language impairments. And I'm going to start by focusing on technology. I'm going to start by focusing on syntax, and then I'm going to talk about modularity between language and other cognitive abilities, within language, between syntax, phonology, pragmatics, lexicons, and a little bit about modularity within syntax, because even when a child has a deficit in syntax, it's not that all of his syntax is gone. Some parts of the syntax are impaired. Okay, and I'll start with the syntactic impairment, and I'll start with an example. So what does it mean to have a problem in syntax? So I'm going to show you something that a girl, 12-year-old girl, said when I showed her these two pictures. Right, you see, it's a girl kissing grandma kissing a girl. And I asked her, which girl is the grandma kissing? And this is what she says. Say it again, what? And then I say again, which girl is the grandma kissing? And actually, I repeated it several times. And then she says, well, I don't know. Here, and she points to the top figure, here the girl is kissing the grandma. And here the grandma is kissing the girl. So she understands the picture. She understands that it's something that has to do with kissing and grandmas and girls. But then she says, could you ask this again? And I repeat, which girl is the grandma kissing? And then she says, I don't know. Do other children know? Right? And the answer is, other children do know. So children who have no language impairments, in Hebrew and Arabic, but also in many other languages, at the age of 6 or 7, they already master these kinds of sentences. They understand these kind of sentences. But children who have syntactic impairments have specific difficulty with these sentences. Now, try to look at the structure of the sentence, which girl is the grandma kissing, and think what is so difficult about this structure. When we look at where the agent is and where the theme is, we see that actually the grandma is kissing, but she doesn't appear first in the sentence, right? It is the girl that is the theme of the action that appears first. And the idea is that probably this is what makes these things difficult. The grandma is actually kissing the girl, but the girl appears in the beginning of the sentence. Another example of a sentence that is very difficult for the same girl and for the other hundreds of children that we tested, show me the woman that the girl draws. You see that in this case, I don't ask a question, but do you see that it's the same structure? We have the woman that the girl draws, the woman. So the woman is being drawn, but it's actually in the beginning of the sentence. Another example from a different child. I showed him a sentence. He saw the sentence in writing, and he just had to read it for as long as he wanted and to explain the sentence. And the sentence was, the swimmer that the witch pushed jumped. And he says, and he's 15 years old. Remember that at the age of 6, they are supposed to be able to understand these kind of sentences. Oh, the swimmer and the witch pushed and jumped. So it was in Hebrew, so he said pushed in the plural and jumped in the plural. So they probably both pushed and both jumped. And then I asked him who pushed whom, and he says they pushed. You can't tell from the sentence, right? So why can't you tell from the sentence? If you don't have the syntactic structure to be able to, the ability to process this kind of syntactic structure, then you will not be able to tell from the sentence. And then he decided and said, okay, probably they both drowned. That was his conclusion. So there was pushing. He did understand the words, right? He understood that there was a swimmer and the witch and the pushing and jumping, but he couldn't tell who did what to whom because you need the syntactic structure in order to understand what's going on in the sentence. And again, you see that there is something about a constituent of the sentence that is not in its right place. Right? So we have the swimmer that appears in the beginning, but actually it was the swimmer that was pushed. So we have the witch pushed the swimmer in the normal order, the witch pushed the swimmer, and then the swimmer appears before the witch, and this is what makes the sentence so difficult. Now, it's not only in understanding written sentences and understanding heard sentences. Even when we ask them to repeat these sentences, it might be very, very difficult. Look at these sentences on the left. This is a translation from Hebrew, so if some sentences don't sound very English to you, you're right. But in Hebrew, all these sentences are okay. And for example, this is an 11-year-old child. He could repeat a sentence, yesterday the ball rolled in the garden. But he couldn't repeat a sentence like, which teacher does the girl like? And instead he said, which teacher does the teacher like? Okay? He doesn't understand who does what to whom in the sentence, and therefore he takes the teacher to be the agent of the action and also the theme of the action. Look at which guide does the boy like. You already know these kind of sentences where the components move. Which guide does the boy like? He repeats, which guide does the student like? So something is not right, and in this case, it just changes a word. This policeman, the neighbor saw. This policeman, this neighbor, the policeman saw. So he, again, he knows that there was a neighbor and a policeman and seeing, but he doesn't know what's going on. Right? And again, if you look at the colorful sentences compared to the light blue ones, you see that the colorful sentences are sentences that have this kind of irregular order of constituents, where the object or the theme appears before the agent. And these are sentences that we call sentences with syntactic movement. Why do we call them syntactic movement? Because something moved to another position. So if you look at the three sentences that he couldn't repeat, they included movement. Something was not in the original position, whereas he was able to repeat, the girl likes this teacher. So he can repeat, the girl likes this teacher, but he cannot repeat, which teacher does the girl like? So these are the same words, the same, more or less the same semantics of the words, but still one is possible to repeat, he can repeat and the other he can't. Why can't he repeat? It's not memory, right? If he had just had a problem in memory, in repeating sentences just because of memory, he wouldn't be able to repeat the last sentence as well. The problem is syntactic, and it is very specific syntactically. It is when the theme of the action appears in the beginning before the agent of the action. So if we look at sentences, basic sentences, we look at sentences like the girl draws the woman, this is the usual order in English, in French, in Hebrew, in Arabic. But then if we have something like which woman does the girl draw, then we'll have what we call syntactic movement. And now you can see why it's called syntactic movement. Something is born in one position and is moving to another position in the sentence. And what I want to say, to claim, is that in many languages now we know that this is one of the core clinical markers for syntactic impairment in children and adults. This kind of syntactic movement is very difficult for them to comprehend and to produce. And I'm going to show you some examples of how we assess, how we test whether someone can understand these sentences and how we test whether they can produce these sentences. And what I'm going to show you about the syntactic part, about the syntactic SLI part, is data from 197 children with this kind of impairment. It's not something that you collect in one day, but it's data that was collected in the last, I think, 13 years. And the data is about Hebrew and about Palestinian Arabic. But it generalizes to many other languages that we know. So if we look at specific sentences that are very common around us and still include this kind of syntactic movement, we have questions like, which woman did the girl draw? We have relative clauses like the woman that the girls drew, and we have what we call topicalization, not very common in English, but you would say something like this woman the girls drew. And all these structures involve this kind of movement, which is called WH movement. And now it's evident why it's called WH movement. It's the movement that we see in WH questions, questions like who, which woman, etc. So how do we assess if someone understands this kind of sentences with WH movement? One thing that we could do, as I showed you before, is show two pictures. Now, because we know that the problem is with who is the agent and who is the theme, we will show two pictures with reversed roles. So we would show, for the question, show me the woman that the girl is drawing, we would show a girl drawing a woman and a woman drawing a girl. So I'm going to start with showing you data about what we call relative clauses, comparing relative clauses in which the theme of the action moves to a position before the agent. These are the object relatives. And to the simpler one, the subject relatives, where we do have movement, but the movement doesn't change the order of the agent and the theme. And of course, we always compare them to simple sentences. Why is it so important to include simple sentences in tasks like that? First of all, for the smile factor. We want them, the participants to smile from time to time, to feel that they succeeded. And if we give them simple sentences without movement, we are quite sure that they will succeed and feel that at least in some of the sentences in the task, they are fine. The other reason is a methodological reason. We want to make sure that they understand the task, they understand the pictures, they understand the words, right? So if they are okay with the simple sentences, then we say, okay. So simple sentences are fine, the lexical items are fine, the pictures are fine, the task is fine. So if they fail in understanding object relatives, it's because they have a specific problem in syntax. So how would it look if we ask them something like, show me the woman that the girl is drawing, or show me the elephant that the boy is washing. You see that there are two elephants, one is washing the boy, the boy is washing another elephant. What we see is that they have a selective deficit in understanding the sentences when they involve movement of the theme across the agent. So in object relatives, what you see here is the orange is usually the interesting color, so the interesting group. Orange here is the syntactic impairment group, and they are compared, and they are from age 9 to 16, and we compare them to children with normal language, with typical language, in first and second grade, so 6 and 7 year olds. And you can see that the 6 and 7 year olds are much better than them in understanding object relatives, right? So there is a deficit that is specific to syntactic movement. What does it mean in real life? That if I tell them point to the grandma that the girl is kissing, they don't know which picture to point to. Now, you can see it also when they try to explain to you what's difficult for them in the sentences. So this is an example of a sentence, show me the boy that the clown feeds, and you see a boy feeding a clown who's feeding another boy. And then this participant, he was in seventh grade, so he was 12, and he said, no, wait, show you the boy, and then I continue, that the clown feeds. He says, the clown feeds him. I didn't understand what you want to see who that feeds the clown or that the clown feeds the boy. You see that he knows about feeding and about clowns and about boys, but he doesn't know what exactly I want from him. And I repeat the sentence, and he says, the clown, they didn't, this and this one, show me the boy, and then I continue that the clown feeds. And he says, this one, and he points to the clown. Okay, why does he point to the clown? Because at some point he just understands that he can't understand the whole sentence, and he says, okay, the clown feeds, and he points to the clown. So this is the case with relative clauses, like the boy that the clown feeds. It's also the case with WH questions. And imagine how important WH questions are for our everyday life. It's not only that in class they are asked questions. It's not only that in exams they are asked questions. This is the way we communicate. We ask questions, we answer questions. So understanding questions and being able to produce questions is very crucial for everything. So let's see what is going on with WH questions. We said that WH questions have exactly the same type of movement. So if we want to say which woman did the girl draw, we will move the woman to the beginning of the sentence, like that. And again, what we do, we give questions in which the movement changes the order of the agent and the theme, and sentences in which they don't. And what we see, and we give questions like that, which dog does the cat bite? Which elephant is the boy washing? And not to be able to understand the question would be not to know to which of the figures to point. And indeed, this is what we see. So they are very, very poor in understanding the object questions. Which elephant does the boy wash? So if we say, if we ask something like, this is an example of, again, a seventh grader, and a different seventh grader, and I ask, for some reason, the question mark is on the left. I ask, which girl does the woman photograph? And he says, I didn't understand the sentence. She photographs her, but she her. I don't get it. Right? So you understand the picture, but not the sentence. Now, it's not only when they hear the sentences. It's also when they see the sentences in written form in front of them. So if they have to say, if they have to look at the sentence and explain it, and we give sentences with exactly the same lengths, more or less the same words, and we ask them to explain the sentences, sentences with syntactic movement and sentences without syntactic movement, what we see is that they are able, again, the syntactic impairment is in the orange columns, and you see that they are, like the controls, they are able to explain simple sentences without movement, but they are not able to explain written sentences with movement, even if it's in front of their eyes and we give them unlimited time to have a look, to look at the sentence, to try to understand it, it doesn't help. They understand the word, they don't understand the syntactic structure, and therefore they don't understand who did what to whom in the sentence. So that's an example. The sentence was, the puppy that the boy wants, it's chicken soup. It happens in Israel. And then HD, a 12-year-old, said, that's hard. And then I ask her, what's hard? And she says, well, deciding who eats the soup. And Romanov Ogrodsky, my collaborator, asks her, who can it be? And she says, well, either the boy or the puppy. I don't know. Right? So again, she doesn't know who does what to whom. You see that it is a deficit that is very specific to syntactic movement. And we see it as a problem in understanding sentences that we hear and sentences that we read. Is it only a problem in comprehension? Or does it also affect production? How do we test production? If someone has a problem with this kind of structures, how do we force them to try and produce this kind of structures? So one test that we, it took us some 3 years to think about this test, but now we are happy with it and we ran it for several hundred children with language impairments, it's the following one. We tell them, imagine there are two children. One child gives a present, one child receives a present. Which child would you rather be? Please start with your response with the child, okay? And then you see that they will have to produce something like the child that receives a present, right? This would be a subject relative. It is a movement, but movement that doesn't change the order of the agent and the theme. Now let's look at the object relative elicitation. Imagine there are two children. One child wakes, the father wakes up one child, the alarm clock wakes up one child. Which child would you rather be? Now, if they have to start with, I would rather be, then they will have to say, the child that the father wakes up. You see here the movement, the father wakes up the child, and then the child moves. And then we can see if they are able to produce these sentences or not. What we see is that they are completely unable to produce object relatives like that, and they are much, much worse than the controls. Controls who are much younger than them. So what does it mean not to be able to produce this kind of sentence? This is one girl who was 15 when she came to us. And we told her there are two girls, the butterfly touches one girl, the mosquito touches one girl. Which girl would you rather be? And she said, I would rather be a butterfly. Okay, which is beautiful. But it's not exactly the syntactic structure that we were aiming at. Another boy, a 12-year-old boy. There are two boys. The air conditioning warms up one boy. The air conditioning cools down one boy. Which boy would you rather be? Very important in Israel. And he responds, I want to be the boy that cools down the air condition. Okay? So again, he understands. He wants the cooling down. But he cannot say the syntactic structure in a way that the theme will be the first. So the boy that the air conditioning is cooling down. Now, does it go away with age? I know it's a very, there are a lot of numbers here, but I'll take you step by step here. Let's start. So what you see here is the 163 children with syntactic impairments compared to 87 controls with good language. This is a study with Maya Echini and Ronit Sterman. And what you can see below in blue is the control performance. And each column is a different age. So you can see that already when they are between seven and a half and eight, they are able to produce subject relatives, they are able to produce object relatives in this task, no problem. And it doesn't change. They are able at eight, at the age of eight, at the age of nine, at the age of 11 to 16. Okay? So this is something that they do without any problem. Now let's look at the orange place, the orange part on top. These are the syntactic SLI children. Look, when they are seven, they produce 33% correct object relatives. When they are eight, 35, 9, 27, 10, 27, 11, 33, 12, 41, 13, 40, 41, 14 to 16, 39. So what you can see here is that it's a problem that remains. So the age changes, but sadly, their performance doesn't. So it's not something that you could say, this is a problem only of children until the age of nine. This is something that persists unless we treat it. And it is possible to treat it, but this is something that we should know that exists in any age. And actually now we work with several adults they usually don't know that they have a syntactic problem, but they say, well, it's difficult for me to understand long sentences, or they say, I'm getting very tired when I try to read a book. Of course you get very tired when you try to read a book because it contains a lot of sentences with movement. Now, just I'll shortly also show you that we have the same results in Palestinian Arabic. This is work by Manal Haddad Khanna. And here we tested 22 children, again between the age of 9 and 14. And we see again that they are not able to understand object relatives. These are the, it's a bit confused, but the light green is the SLI children, and you see that they are impaired in understanding object relatives, and they are very impaired also in producing object relatives. So now the interesting pattern is the SLIs, the Arabic, Palestinian Arabic speaking children with syntactic impairments, and you see that they have difficulties producing object relatives. Now at this point you might say, okay, so they don't understand sentences with this kind of weird WH movement. Is it really that serious? Do they really hear these sentences? Do they really need to use these sentences? And how common is this syntactic impairment? So I'm going to answer these two questions. How often do we use sentences that include movement? For example, sentences that include movement include movement. And what we see here, first of all, is we counted the sentences in, we looked at children's books, in children's songs, in textbooks of first and second grade. And we counted the number of sentences with movement and the number of sentences without movement. We did it both for Hebrew and for Palestinian Arabic. And what we see is more or less a third of the sentences that we say include movement. The sentences that we say is a sentence that includes movement. It's almost impossible to say sentences that do not include movement. For example, sentences that do not include movement is a sentence that includes movement. So what we see is that in the input, the children's input, we see a third of the sentences that children hear include WH movement. So it's really crucial to be able to understand these sentences and to be able to produce them. Now, how often or how common is this syntactic impairment? Maybe there is one child like that in one country. Maybe it's not that horrible. I think it will be horrible in that case also, but how do we assess it? So what we do is, first of all, we go to schools and we assess the whole age. So we test five classes of children in fourth grade. And we see how many children we see there with this kind of impairment. And usually in each class, we see three or four children who sit in normal classes who have this kind of impairment. So more or less 10%. But the other thing that we did was we went to two schools, and this is a study with Maya Yachini and Adi Kesselman and Ofer Zahavi. And what we did was we took a whole school, two schools, and we tested all the children in these schools. And these are children that are studying in schools for learning disabilities. So they are not diagnosed with language impairments, of course, but it is learning disability school. And then the question would be, if a child has a learning disability, what is the probability that they would have a syntactic problem? How common is it? So what we did was testing each of these children in these two schools, testing them with many, many syntactic tests, as well as lexical tests and phonological tests that I'm going to show you soon, and asking whether they are impaired in this case in syntactic movement. And what you can see here, each row is a different child, and each column is a different test, and the pink is significantly below controls, okay? So almost in syntactic tasks. So what you can see here is that almost all of these children, none of them were diagnosed with language impairments or with syntactic impairments. Almost all of them have this kind of syntactic deficit in WH movement. And if we just look at percentages, we were completely shocked when we looked at the first school. We calculated how many of these children failed in three tests, syntactic tests or more, and the result was 86%. So 86% of the children who are diagnosed as general learning disability actually have a problem with syntactic movement. It's a huge percent. We said that in normal classes we see something like 10%. In children with learning disability, we see 86%, which is really huge. And then this was the first school, and then we went to the other school, tested the whole school, and the result was 86%. So there is this syntactic impairment is not often diagnosed, but is very, very common, and it affects the ability of children to understand and to produce sentences. So it is common, and it is important. So this is the part about syntactic movement and syntactic deficits. Now I want to move to the modularity and ask whether, when someone has a syntactic deficit, is it specific? So is it only a deficit in syntax, or maybe the deficit affects other cognitive abilities and other language abilities? And the first immediate question to ask is, what about their IQ? Is their IQ okay? So there are various ways to estimate IQ. One of them would be the Raven matrix, where they see a figure and they have to select one of six figures that will match the missing place. And this is considered a kind of estimate of nonverbal IQ. And when we tested here 36 children with very impaired syntactic movement processing. So their syntax is impaired, but their IQ is fine. So out of these 36 children, the Z-score was minus 1.8, so it's marginal, but all the others had normal IQ or even above normal IQ. Okay. What it means is that this syntactic impairment is not due to problems in IQ, and it doesn't have to be to come together. Actually, usually it doesn't come together. So we have a selective deficit in syntax that is not related to IQ. Another question is whether it has something to do with memory, with phonological working memory, our ability to hold these words. So we might think, okay, they are not able to hold all these words in their memory when they hear the sentence, and this is why they don't understand the sentence. So first of all, you saw that also when they see the sentence written, they have exactly the same problem. Secondly, you saw that they cannot produce these sentences. So it's not only about phonological working memory, but still we wanted to be convinced. So what we did was, working with these syntactic impaired children, we tested their phonological working memory. And this is a study with Roman Novogrodsky. What we did was, these are 19 Hebrew-speaking children with SLI, and we tested, and who had very impaired comprehension of object relatives and object-which questions and production of these things, and we tested their spans. Span tasks is when you give someone a list of words or a list of non-words or a list of numbers, and you ask them to immediately repeat this list. And you see how many numbers they can repeat or how many words they can repeat. And then you can compare it to the norm for the age. And we did it with words and long words and with non-words, with words that do not exist. And what we find is that only 2 of these 19 children with syntactic impairment had problems in phonological working memory. Or maybe I can be more positive and say 17 of the 19 children actually had good phonological working memory. Their problem was not in phonological memory. Their problem was in syntax. Later, we worked with another group of children, with 36 children with syntactic impairments. And again, we tested their spans of words and non-words and long words. And again, 18 of them had good phonological working memory. So you definitely might have a deficit. Someone might have a deficit in syntax, in syntactic movement, without a problem in phonological working memory. So we see here a dissociation, a very clear dissociation, and a very clear modularity between phonological working memory on the one hand and syntax or WH movement on the other. Now I want to dive into the modularity within. So can we see, do children with syntactic SLI have a problem with other language domains? Do children with problems in other language domains have problems in syntax? And I'm going to start with, actually, because we talked about phonological working memory, I'm going to talk about children who have a problem with phonological working memory, what we might call FOSLI, phonological SLI. So children with FOSLI, and in this specific case, it's problem not in phonology in general, in phonological working memory, do they have a problem in syntax? Do they have a problem with WH movement? What is their problem? So I'm going to dedicate some time now to tell you about phonological language developmental phonological impairment. And this is a study with Revital Guggenheim, where we worked with 15 children and adolescents and adults with this kind of phonological working memory problem. And when we look at their spans, we talked about word span, non-word span, etc., their spans were significantly below the control. So each of these participants performed below their age for memory. They couldn't remember many words. Some of them could only remember 2 words. And the question would be, how would it affect syntax? They also had very, very poor repetition of non-words, poor repetition of words. Now, when we talk about this kind of phonological working memory, which we call the phonological output buffer, there are several jobs that this kind of buffer has. One is just working memory. It holds the phonemes until we are able to produce them. But the other thing that it does, it allows for assembling of words. So, for example, if we read a word that we do not know yet, so we have different phonemes that we want to assemble. We need to hold these phonemes and then assemble them. This is what the phonological buffer does. But it doesn't only assemble phonemes, it also assembles morphemes. So if we have something like tables, it takes the word table, or the phonemes of the word table, it takes the s and combines them together. It does the morphological combination. And now, if we assume that this is the component that doesn't have the morphological combination, you can already think about these children who have a problem in this phonological working memory, and you can understand that they will have a problem with morphologically complex words. And this is they also have numbers, and there's a beautiful work by Dror Dotan. We're happy to have him sit here in the audience. And what Dror Dotan did was looking at individuals with brain damage who have a problem in this component, in this phonological working memory. And what they had, it turns out that it's not only this kind of component, not only combines phonemes to create words and morphemes to create morphologically complex words, it also combines digits to multi-digit numbers. So if we want to say a number like 2,345, what we need to do is to take this number words and to combine them together, and this component is doing it, and indeed the patients that Dror tested had problems with saying these multi-digit numbers, and they substituted one number with another. So what does it mean for phonological working memory impaired children? It means that they are unable to, they have problems in reading numbers, they have problems in reading words, they have problems in naming words, in saying the, when they see a picture, in saying the word, because they make phonological errors. They have problems especially with phonologically complex words and non-words, and with morphologically complex words and non-words, and they make morphological errors, like instead of saying thinking, saying think. Instead of saying disagreements, saying agreeing. Why? Because they have a problem in this component that is in charge of the morphological structure. And the problem is both in reading and in repetition and in spontaneous speech. Now to our question, what about their syntax? Are they able to understand WH questions? Are they able to understand relative clauses? Can they produce them? And I'm happy to say that they can. So if we look, for example, at their ability to say, I would rather be the girl that the butterfly touches, they are fine. They can produce subject relatives. They can produce object relatives. What about their ability to understand these kind of sentences when they are written? No problem. They understand object relatives and they can explain them later. What about this sentence picture matching when they see a girl kissing grandma and grandma kissing girl? Can they, even though they only remember two words, can they understand these sentences? And the answer is yes. Here the interesting pattern is pink, and you compare them to the controls in their age and you see that they have no problem with questions, they have no problems with relative clauses. Also, when we ask them to judge the agreement of verbs, tense and agreement, the inflection of verbs, they are fine. So what we see here, we see a double dissociation between the ability, the syntax on the one hand, and the phonological working memory on the other. So we see individuals with good syntax and poor phonological working memory, and other individuals with poor syntax and good phonological working memory, which means that language developmental language impairments may be very, very selective, and they may affect phonology, and they may affect syntax, and it could be completely selective. How much time do I have? Okay. So I'm going to very quickly tell you about two other types of language impairments, and then I'm going to finish with 6 minutes about the critical period. Leslie, what is Leslie? Lexical SLI. We said that what among the abilities, the language abilities that we have is to retrieve words. So if we want to say a word, we have to retrieve it from semantics through the phonological system in order to say the word. There are children who have a deficit especially exactly in this thing, in retrieving words. Do they have a problem in syntax? So this is based on four different studies with 55 children with lexical SLI, with impairment in lexical retrieval. And when we test them, how do we test impairments in lexical retrieval? We can ask them to name pictures. We can give them a definition. What is a very tall animal that lives in Africa and eats leaves from the trees? Right? And they have to give the name. We can ask them to repeat words. We can ask them to say as many names of animals that they can in 1 minute. We can do various things, and this is the naming test. And what we can see is whether they are able to retrieve the words, whether they are able to find the words we need them to find. So this is one example of a child with Leslie with this developmental anomia, developmental problem in finding words. And he was trying, I showed him this very important vegetable, and in Hebrew it's chatzil, and he was trying to find the word. And he said, no, I bought it yesterday I bought it in the supermarket. No, not chavitzal, remember it's supposed to be chatzil. Chavitzal is a phonological error. What's the name of this thing? Voila, the whole name ran away. I always knew it. No, what is this purple thing called? It ran away. And then I asked him, what category does it belong to? And he looks at me as if, what am I, crazy? I don't know. So it's vegetables. And then he continues to try. Chavitzal, no, something like chavtzal, chavatzelet. And then I say ch, he doesn't know. Cha, he doesn't know. Chatzi, and then he says chatzil, and he's very happy. So what you see here is that actually he has the word in his lexicon. It's not a problem in vocabulary. Sometimes people talk about small vocabulary size. It's not a small vocabulary. The word exists in his memory, but he cannot retrieve it from there. So when we talk about lexical retrieval problems, Leslie, or anomia, we talk about normal vocabulary that cannot be accessed, or cannot be that where the item cannot be activated to be retrieved. And of course, this impairment can be in various, there is a whole process that I'm not going to go into now, but there is a whole process of retrieving words. We start with the concept, we think about a giraffe, we go to a semantic lexicon that is organized by semantic categories, and then we go to the phonological output lexicon where we know what the phonological form of the word is, and then we go to our acquaintance, the phonological output buffer, this phonological working memory component. And only then we are able to produce the word. So each of these can be selectively impaired and give rise to a different type of lexical SLI. And in a study with Raman Novogrodsky and Varda Kreiser, what we were able to show is that there are, for example, we found 6 children with a problem only in the semantic lexicon. They make only semantic errors. Children with only a problem in the phonological lexicon. They make phonological errors and also semantic errors. And children with a problem in the phonological buffer. So not only is it a selective deficit in lexical retrieval, we also see selective deficits of lexical retrieval in different stages of the lexical retrieval process. Now, what about their syntax? Fine. So the orange is again the syntactic SLI children that you saw before. The yellow, the banana color, is the controls, the typically developing children, and now the crimson color, the Bordeaux, is the lexical SLI. And what you can see is that they are able to understand object relatives, they are able to understand object questions, they are able to produce object questions and object relatives. So in fact, their syntax is fine, even though their lexical retrieval is very, very impaired. So again, we have here a very selective impairment that affects lexical retrieval, but not syntax. Before we had an impairment in phonological SLI, an impairment in phonology that does not affect syntax. And we also have the other direction of children who have only syntactic impairment without problems in lexical retrieval, without problems in phonology. Now I'm only very briefly going to say something about theory of mind and then go to the critical period. What about theory of mind? We talked about pragmatics. We talked about problems in being able to understand the rules of discourse. Can a child who has a problem in theory of mind or in pragmatics also have normal syntax? And this is mainly studies by Noga Balaban, also studies by Raman Novogrodsky and Yael Shmueli. We see children, and I'm sure you know friends or husbands of friends who would give you the right structure of the sentence, but not always exactly what you wanted to hear, right? So sometimes they will give you too much information, sometimes they will not give you enough information, and sometimes the information will be very obscure. So for example, they might meet you and say, "He told me that they are already there." Okay, the structure is fine. The syntactic structure of the sentence, "He told me that they are already there," is fine. But the problem is that you are not able to understand what is going on. Why aren't you able to understand who is he and who are they? Because you are not in their mind. And the problem in theory of mind is a problem in being able to see the world from a different person's perspective and being able to know that there are differences between your perspective and the perspective of another person. Now, if you don't take into account the perspective of another person, you might start a sentence or a whole discussion with he, because you know who you're talking about and you don't understand that the other person does not know what you're talking about. And when we talk about children like that, their teachers often say that they have problems in conversation, that the texts that they write are incoherent, that they use pronouns like he without setting the reference, and that their discourse is very strange. So when we test that, for example, we show them a giraffe that is measuring a girl who is measuring another giraffe, and we ask them, "Who is measuring the girl?" And they say, "The giraffe." Okay? So it might be that their syntax is fine, but you cannot know it, and they don't take into account the fact that there are 2 giraffes, and you will not know which one to choose. Or sometimes they would say the one with the spots. Okay, both of them have spots. So it does affect language, but it is not a language impairment. It is an impairment that affects language, but what I think is it's not a type of language impairment, it is a type of cognitive impairment that has effects on language. I'll just give you an example of how these children produce object relatives. So we have one item where there are two girls, the doctor examines one girl and the nurse examines one girl, and we ask them, which girl would you rather be? And this girl, she was 12, she said, well, I want to be the girl that the nurse examines, right? It's a good object relative, because a doctor is someone that you take more care of, more severely, and a nurse is like, she has a smaller role, and a doctor is, if you have a fracture or something like this, in our previous school, the nurse gave injections and such things, and there was no doctor, just a nurse, because there are no severe cases, right? And what would a control child do? Say, I want to be the girl that the nurse examines. Okay, so what you can see here is that the syntax is actually fine, but something is wrong about understanding what I want from her. Something is wrong about understanding the task. This is a different kind of developmental impairment. It is a developmental impairment that affects discourse rules, but I think it's much larger. It's not limited to language. It is a deficit that affects theory of mind. What about their syntax? Completely fine. In this case, the pragmatic ones are in a gray, and what you can say is that they are great. So they are just like the normals. They understand object relatives, they produce object relatives, they understand object questions and produce them. So if I summarize this part, what we see is that there are subtypes of specific language impairments. We have specific language impairments. We can have children with syntactic SLI without a problem in memory, without a problem in IQ, without a problem in finding words, without a phonological problem, and without a pragmatic problem. And we can see other types of specific language impairments. Impairments in lexical retrieval, impairments in phonology, and I called it Prasley here, but I think it's not accurate. I think it's not a language impairment, it is a cognitive impairment that affects language, but without any problem in syntax. Now I want to finish by talking about sources of these kinds of language impairments. Why should anyone have a problem in language? Any kind of problem, syntactic problem, lexical problem, phonological problem. So many people talk about genetics, I'm not going to talk about it today, but I want to have a look at this question of language impairments through the looking glass of children with hearing impairment. When we talk about children with hearing impairment, you know that only 10% of children with hearing impairment are born to deaf children and are using sign language. 90% of the children who are born deaf do not use sign language, and they try to use the oral language around them. So these are this study is a study with 65 Hebrew-speaking children with Ronit Shtelman, and with 24 Palestinian Arabic children, adults and adolescents, with the Manar Haddad Hanna, and what we were testing was exactly what you already know. We tested their syntax, their WH movement, understanding object relatives, producing object relatives, understanding WH questions, and producing WH questions. And what you can see here in a nutshell is that they have a severe problem in WH movement. Now, why should children who are born deaf and use oral language to communicate have a syntactic problem in WH movement? It's very peculiar. Why is it the case? And what we thought is that we can use the fact that some of these children did not have a WH movement problem and try to see what characterizes the ones who had a problem in WH movement and in what way they are different from those who could not understand WH movement, right? So the difference between the ones who are good in syntax and the ones who are bad in syntax. Now, we are talking about deaf children, right? So the first thing that we thought was maybe the ones who have, you know, cochlear implants, those who had operation and had a cochlear implant implanted, maybe they are better than the ones who carry a hearing aid on the ear. And the answer is no. There was no difference between those who had the cochlear implants and those who had hearing devices. What about the depth of hearing loss? Maybe those who are very, very deaf will be worse than the ones who have only medium hearing loss. So what we did, we did a correlation between the depth of hearing loss, how deaf they are, and how good they are in understanding sentences. And actually, there was no correlation. And if we did find correlation, it was the opposite correlation. So the ones who had the deepest hearing loss were actually the ones who understood sentences better. How can that be? Now think about children who are very, very severely, profoundly deaf. Probably people will know that they are profoundly deaf earlier, right? They will notice. They will give them hearing devices earlier. And this is actually what we find. The ones who get their hearing devices earliest are the ones who have good syntax. And specifically in this study, what we find is that if a child gets input, language input, a hearing aid until the age of 8 months, then their syntax is later fine. Right? Why is the hearing device important? Because in this case, they get language input. If you think about a deaf child who does not get a hearing aid, in fact, they don't have language input. So the finding is the following. If they get language input during the first 8 months of life, then they can be fine later. Their syntax can be okay. However, if they do not get language input in this time, they might show impairments in WH movement. Now, of course, it doesn't have to be spoken language. Now we are doing a study with, this is Doron Levin, we are doing a study with sign language, with the French sign language and Israeli sign language, Italian sign language, Turkish sign language, German, and Catalan. And what we're trying to see is what happens to these children who do not get hearing aids during the first year of life, but they do get another language, a natural language, sign language. And what our first results show that actually it doesn't matter what kind of language they get. They have to get some kind of language. And if they get some sign language during the first year of life, they might later develop completely a fine syntax. So it is about input in the first year of life. Now there is another, and with this I'm going to finish, there is another source of syntactic impairment that we found actually with Iris Fatal and Aviva Fatal and myself. We found due to a catastrophe that happened in Israel 13 years ago, where there was a formula, there was a child formula, a milk formula that did not include B1, the vitamin thiamine. And thiamine is a crucial player in brain development. It plays a role in metabolism, in building the membranes, transmitters. It is very, very crucial for all the Krebs circle, for glucose, for the use of glucose in the brain. So it's really, really crucial. And the point about this kind of vitamin B1, thiamine, is that it is depleted after, if for 2 weeks or 3 weeks a child does not get this kind of vitamin, then there is no storage of this vitamin in the body. So it means that after 2 weeks or 3 weeks of this vitamin deficiency, it will start affecting the brain. And we tested these children, 61 of these children, when they were 5, and later when they were 8 and 9, and now we're testing them when they are 13. And we tested how is their language. And what we find is that 97% of these children have a language impairment. And when we look at their syntax is the one that is mostly affected. They don't understand object relatives, object questions. They cannot produce object relatives. And they have a very difficult time with syntax, with WH movement in general. So what I want to suggest, and it's important to know that thiamine deficiency occurs also in adults. So, for example, there is a Korsakoff syndrome after alcoholism, and also after some bariatric operations, people suffer thiamine deficiency. They have memory problems, but they do not have syntactic problems. They do not have language problems. So it is something about the fact that they did not get thiamine during the first year of life that affected their later development of syntax. So in a way, we see another evidence for a critical period of the development of syntax that is in the first year of life. Here we see that it is the nutrition that affected the later development of syntax. So we see that input is important. This is what we learned from the hearing impaired children. And we see that the development of the brain during this critical period, during this first year of life, is important. And we need both. We need the input and we need the development of the brain in order to, during the first year of life, in order to later develop good syntax. Now, importantly, the syntax was affected, but lexical ability was not necessarily affected, and phonological ability was not necessarily affected, and their conceptual abilities were not affected. So each of these 55 children who had a syntactic deficit due to lack of thiamine during the first year of life was tested for their lexicon and their phonology, etc., and their conceptual abilities. 22 of them had good lexical abilities. So although they did not get the thiamine during the critical period for brain development, the lexicon developed fine. 33 of them had good phonological abilities. And almost all of them had good conceptual abilities. What it means is that even though you miss the critical period for syntax development, you might develop good lexical abilities, you might develop good phonological abilities, and good conceptual abilities. And this means that modularity not only exists in the selectivity of language impairments, it also exists in critical periods. So there might be different critical periods for different language abilities. For example, we might have a specific critical period for syntax that is completely different from critical period for other language abilities, and maybe for some language abilities there is no critical period. At this point, we don't know. So I'm summarizing and saying that there are specific language impairments, different types of language impairments that affect different language domains. We may have syntactic deficits without deficits in IQ, without deficits in working memory, and I'm going to jump to this one. Language exposure during the first year of life is crucial for the later development of syntactic movement. So I thank my lab, the Language and Brain Lab, and the funding agencies, and you. Thank you.